And welcome back to Fully Equipped, your Gear Focus podcast, where we take a look at weekly PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers' ball skill levels. I'm Jonathan Wall, managing editor for gear at golf.com. Joined as always by Andrew Tursky, senior equipment editor for golf.com, and Chris McCormick, VP of Tour and Education at TruSpec. What's going on, guys?
Gentlemen, how we doing?
That's a fancy title you got there, Chris.
I made it myself.
Oh, okay. There you go. That makes sense. Smart man.
Well, yeah. I mean, go big or go home, right?
It took you like four or five episodes of having Chris on the pod now for Tursky to realize he has a fancier title than us. Anytime you have education in there, that must mean you're a pretty smart guy.
For real. Doing the world a service. Thank you.
I've always been told if you don't know how to do it, surround yourself with people smarter than you, and it makes you look good. Mm-hmm. No. We got a good staff.
Well said. All right. Well, before we get into gear, guys, I want to get your take. PGA of America just came out with a new set of rules for distance measuring devices for the major championships. They're now going to allow caddies to use rangefinders at the majors, including the PGA Championship. What did you guys think when you heard that they were going to be allowing rangefinders?
Finally.
Wow.
That's what I think. Like, why not? I mean, they get pretty accurate numbers to anywhere they want on the green anyway. You know what I mean? It just takes longer. It's just slowing the game down, in my opinion. Like, they get the number anyway, eventually. It just takes 4 or 5 minutes. Let's speed it up. I mean, we all like using rangefinders. I don't see any problem with it, honestly.
Chris?
I'm going to agree. I think pace of play. I mean, maybe we get some of those slower guys moving it along a little faster.
Maybe. Wow. I'm kind of surprised. Actually, we'll go the contrarian route. I think this is going to slow down the game. I think you're going to have guys hyper-analyzing it, still doing their normal routine, but then they get a rangefinder. And what the heck happens with the devices that have the slope function? I mean, I don't want to throw on my tinfoil hat here, but I guess I will. Mine fits better than Tursky's, but I mean, who's to say that you couldn't flip the slope function? If people out there aren't familiar with that, a lot of these new rangefinders, they have an ability to, some of them, I know the Bushnell one does, can measure barometric pressure, elevation, you know, basically give you the exact yardage regardless of where you're at.
I wouldn't mind seeing them not allow a GPS that has slope functionality.
I think you're going to have to.
But I know there's like functionality on all those GPSs where it kind of shows up if you actually have the slope function on. Like, you can toggle the system. Plus, it's like cheating. Like, just don't have the slope function on. Like, don't do that.
We've seen some cheating in golf here recently. I'm not going to.
No comment.
No comment, but yeah, that was actually my first thought was, I mean, the slope function, it's literally a switch on some of these devices.
Right.
I mean, there's, I think there was at one point where you could change out the faceplate, so it was a little more visible, but a lot of the new ones, you can just flip a switch, like a light switch. But I guess give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but I think it's going to slow down play just because guys are going to be hyper-analyzing everything. They now have another way to make sure their yardage is right.
They're going to hyper-analyze it regardless. Just give them the yardage quicker. Let's get that let's get that part over with at least. So
that's what I'm thinking. They'll at least be able to get that number that they're looking for when it's a less than ideal shot that maybe the caddy hasn't already pre-plotted for them.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone
will find out soon enough.
Pacing yardage is off anymore. I mean, come on. It's 2020.
What happens if that happens? What happens if guys are pacing off yardages and shooting the number with their rangefinder?
Find them.
Is they going to get a 7-iron over the head?
No warning. Just get a fine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, come on now.
All right. So we had Phoenix last week. It's in your backyard. Tursky, you were out there. And I think you were saying that you were actually out there on the weekend. First, anything you see gear-wise that kind of stuck out to you when you were walking around early in the week, and what were the crowds like on the weekend?
Well, yeah, I was there Tuesday, Wednesday, kind of getting the normal tour bags, tour switches, but Michael Phelps was out there, and it's always fun to catch up with Phelps, see his Scotty Cameron gold medals putter.
There's a real goat.
Yeah,
I mean,
Well, that's
word gets thrown. That it gets thrown around a lot with just random athletes. That is a real goat right there.
Yeah, I mean Brady just won 7. That might be the goat of goats, but Phelps is right up there with Brady, my opinion. But yeah, so I was looking at Phelps' bag, and I actually saw him last year out at the Waste, and he had a whole new bag this year, and he actually had TruSpec on the staff bag. So I figured that he got fit with TruSpec. Chris,
not a bad place to go.
Do you have any intel on his setup? I got some photos of what's in the bag, but
yeah, he actually came to see us here at our Scottsdale studio and worked with our Scottsdale studio supervisor, Eric Johnson. But we got Mr. Phelps into a little bit of a mixed bag, being a brand agnostic company that we are. Yeah, we got him a little bit of Ping. We got him some TaylorMade, got him some Cobra even. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's got G710s in the bag. He's got some TaylorMade milled grind wedges. He put, interestingly enough, the Cobra King utility in a 2-iron, a little driving iron option out there.
Okay. I love looking at Phelps's setups, especially his irons, because they're always so chopped up from playing desert golf. Like, I love that he's just an absolute gamer. Like, ball goes in the desert, Phelps is playing that ball.
But he's playing it with the actual club that he used from that yardage. I mean, that's what I've always been told, is like, have a club that you can chop around in there so you don't ding up your nice new clubs. But that, I love that he actually goes in there with his gamer set and hacks it out.
It's all his irons. It's not just the pitching wedge. No, he does not have a designated desert club, which I love. I respect it. You know, he's a real golfer. He's also looking like he's in swimming shape too. He's looking pretty cut up. I don't know what that translates to in golf, but yeah.
I mean, last year, I remember he came through club tests, and at one point he's like standing over there and he's like, dude, he was wearing like a kind of like a tighter fitting, like long sleeve, like performance shirt. And he's like, dude, I'm like burning up. And he like took his shirt off, like right there in front of everybody. And I was like, I mean, seriously, like he's still in like Olympic shape.
He's jacked.
It's crazy. Yeah, he still is. It's wild. I don't think he'd probably take the putter into the desert. Do you think, Tursky, that Cameron that you saw? It's fire.
No, that thing's way too fire. Keep the cover on that one, please. Please don't chop that one up. But yeah, so that was really fun on Wednesday. And then I actually went back on Sunday because, like you said, it is my backyard. Had a media pass, had to go out there and check out the scene. And it was lively. It was lit. You know what I'm saying?
Kind of surprising for like, how many fans did they say were out there per day? Like 5,000?
I thought it was either 6,000 or 8,000, but it seemed like way more. Like, I was following around the Spieth Xander group for a little bit, and it was like popping. It kind of felt like major-esque. I had never been out there on a Sunday, so it was a really unique experience. And obviously you have the Super Bowl at night, so all the people that are there in the morning, they're like, you know, they're drinking beers kind of pre-gaming for the Super Bowl, and they just happen to be out there watching golf, and they want to follow Spieth. You know, they want to be yelling, hooting, and hollering. And I got to tip my cap to the guys that play with like the bigger names, because as soon as Spieth hits, everyone just starts walking. And now Xander or Scottie Scheffler, like, they have to hit with all that commotion going around, and they're just able to block that out. That's pretty incredible. You know, if like me or you, we go out and a cart starts driving in our backswing, we kind of step off, be like, all right, like, you know, chill out over there. You know, they got thousands and thousands and thousands of people walking in their backswing, and, you know, they're shooting 68. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool to see that focus. But I was standing right behind Spieth as he duck hooked it into the water on 15. That hurt. But it was like, it was a unique situation because people on the crosswalk were just crossing. Like, he had teed his ball up. He was ready to go. Fairway was clear. But there were like hundreds of people still crossing the crosswalk. So Greller has to go to the front of the tee box, be like, hey, can we get some help around here? Like, what's going on? And
everybody's finally, too busy partying.
Right. Like, they're all drunk, you know, and they're screaming, whatever. So they get that situation under control. Spieth's about to hit. And then one last guy just starts like Dion high stepping across with his beer in hand. And everyone just starts cheering him on. And
of course, like, and just goading him at this point to right. keep doing it.
But like as soon as he crosses, Spieth like hits. Like he didn't really take any time off to let the crowd settle down. And I was like, that's kind of weird. And then the ball came off just toe hook right in the water. I was like, man, you know, maybe he should have taken one more deep breath. I don't know what was going on in his head, but like I was saying, these guys might not even notice stuff like that. You know, they deal with that kind of stuff all the time.
A dude I noticed. Stepping.
I very much noticed. You know,
I'm sure they noticed that.
I wasn't drinking beer as part of that crowd. I was just kind of there taking in the experience. And I was like, I don't know if I'd be able to hit a shot right now. Like, this is nerve wracking. You got all that water left. He's fighting. Like, he's in the tournament. He has a chance to win still on that tee. And it was just a wild scene. But, yeah, pretty fun being out there. The waste is – it's a good time. If you ever get the chance, I would definitely take that.
Oh, I mean, if you're looking at tournaments on the schedule, I mean, the Masters is the obvious. If you could go to one, it would be that one. But – like regular tour events, Waste Management has to be one or two. I mean, selfishly, I love RIV.
So you do know? I. We talk about that often, actually. We love RIV. But would you rather win the Waste or Pebble? Probably Waste.
Probably. I mean, it's crazy because Pebble feels like we talk gear on this, and I feel like we're going off the rails a little bit. But like Pebble this week feels like an opposite field event. Like the field for it is really weak, and it's kind of a shame considering the venue. But I was reading some articles, and like players were basically complaining that, you know, you show up to the Monterey Peninsula and you have to figure out new yardages because the ball in that kind of heavy air, you're losing distance.
It's so and cold so, this time of year too.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
I go up there. I got a hoodie. I got a rain jacket. You know, I might have a skull cap on, keep the ears warm. Like it's different than Scottsdale. You know, they go from the Waste to Pebble back to back. That ball's flying way different.
Yeah. I mean, I looked at Furyk, and we'll get into some quick hitter gear notes here in a second, but just looking at Furyk, he switched drivers in Phoenix. And I was like, I wonder what a new driver would do for a guy like Jim Furyk. And I looked in his average driving distance at Torrey was 278. Steve Stricker. His average driving distance was 278. And then at Phoenix, it was 300.
Yeah, part of that's new driver, part of that's ball.
Right. Yeah. It's right, exactly. You just like you're gonna get different distances when you're going from Phoenix to the coast. Or, you know, San Diego or Monterey. But anyway, let's get into some quick hitter gear notes. These are some of the stories that we probably won't go too in depth on. Justin Thomas returned to Titleist TS3 driver. I don't think anybody here on this pod is that surprised. I know JT has been trying to find the shaft for his TSI3. Tursky talked to JJ at Titleist about the driver. You know, it's just trying to find a good fit. Hasn't found it yet. Going back to the TS3, same Mitsubishi driver shaft setup. Another guy that went back to an old driver, Dustin Johnson, and DJ goes on to win overseas with the old sim in the bag. He had been using the sim 2. Justin Rose was spotted with Mizuno MP20 irons, which is, you know, Rosie's a free agent, so we're going to see new gear in his bag from time to time, I'd imagine, and it looks like he's kind of settled on the MP20s. It seems to be Mizuno irons in particular. We've talked about this in the past. Mizuno irons, TaylorMade woods. There seem to be certain clubs that just pop with the, you know, the free agent crowd. Also have Jason Day going back to his old TaylorMade Spider Limited Itsy Bitsy Mallet. And Gary, kind of one of those you just expected. And then Gary Woodland switched to a 9-degree Cobra King Rad Speed XB driver. So some notable names making changes last week. It's still, again, early in the season. I always get people asking me, like, what does DJ not like about the Sim 2 driver? Why is he changing back to Sim? And you just have to realize it's not that he doesn't like the driver. It's that some of these guys just take time to get acclimated to a new product. It happens. It's going to keep happening. But you're going to eventually see the big names getting back to the new product. It just sometimes it takes more time than others. For a guy like DJ, who seems to just like, it's like a plug and play, throw in the shaft and let's go. It seems to be like he's just, you know, trying to kind of find a good setup with the new Sim 2 product. So those are some of the quick hitters. Let's get into the actual gear topics, go a little more in depth. Brooks Koepka wins in Phoenix. And, you know, guys, he's still a free agent. He's still playing what he wants. But it's interesting. Free agents, with the exception of maybe Paul Casey recently, they don't say a whole lot about the gear in their bag. You know, they're not giving credit to, you know, the driver that helped them win or a new set of irons. And Koepka, like, takes that to the extreme. He won't give you a damn thing. It's like tiny little morsels. That's all you're going to get. And if you want to get more, you're going to have to go and do your own searching. And that's what we had again last week. Somebody asked him about his gear setup. You know, he had missed three cuts in a row and, you know, what was he doing differently? And Koepka said, just going back to old stuff. That's it.
When he says stuff like that, I feel like it piques the interest of people that read that even more.
Yeah.
So it's like, then you really want to find out what he's playing. If he just said it, you would be like, oh, okay, yeah. Like he's playing the new TaylorMade. But you know, when he says weird stuff like that, it's like, I mean, almost better. Driver. It's almost better marketing for those.
Oh, it's companies. Great. I mean, you're really diving in. The PGA last year, when they asked him about his going back to the M5 driver, and he admitted, he's like, it's the old driver. I'm not going to call it out by name because they don't pay me.
Mm-hmm.
So don't expect me to give you the name, go figure it out yourself. Well, it's interesting though, because I bring this up, this quote that he gave about the old stuff, because, you know, he's somewhat telling the truth. I mean, he did add Nike's Vaporfly Pro 3-iron. It has a giant cult following. I'm amazed how popular that club is. Anytime we bring it up, people are still screaming about, I have that 3-iron in the bag. I still have a full set.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's always going to be like that. That's the old stuff. And I know that he'd recently gone back to his Vokey, the SM4 with the M grind. And I actually wrote a story maybe about a year or so ago on that lob wedge in particular. Koepka's the only one. I shouldn't say that. He's one of two guys on tour that are using this aggressive M grind. I mean, it has basically zero bounce on it. It just sits so flat on the turf. So he's got a couple of oldies back in the bag, but for the most part, I don't know, again, maybe Koepka's just trying to throw everybody off the scent, but he's got new stuff in the bag.
Yeah. He's got like brand new stuff for a guy that doesn't switch to new stuff. Really. It's like newer than his setup's ever been.
Exactly.
He's so funny, man.
That's the thing. Like, I think kidding. He had to be like tongue planted firmly in cheek.
Yeah.
Because he had switched to a brand new set of Strixon ZX7 irons. And then he adds the new TaylorMade Sim 2 driver to the bag. And he goes on to win in Phoenix. And oh, by the way, both of those new pieces of gear actually they played a pretty large role in his win. I went to go look at the stats. Koepka ranked 11th in strokes gained off the tee with the new driver. Mm-hmm. And he was second in strokes gained approach the green with the new irons. So, you know, yeah, there's some old stuff, but the new stuff for sure seems to be doing the job for Koepka right now.
Yeah, I was actually looking up some stats too. I think like year to date, he's around like 200th in driving accuracy or something really bad. And, you know, with this new Sim 2, they're really focusing on forgiveness. So like it's definitely significantly more forgiving than the M5. So I'm not surprised that he switched to the Sim 2 and not the Sim. I feel like the Sim sat a little weird, at least for me, and was not nearly as forgiving as the Sim 2. And I feel like the Sim 2 is a really nice match for Brooks.
Chris, have you seen anything during testing with Sim 2?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing that we see is with TaylorMade removing that track and freeing up that extra weight, the inclusion of all of that extra carbon in the sole allowed them to make a fantastic player driver, now even more forgiving, being able to redistribute that weight, pull it back, keep that CG a little bit lower and just raise that MOI up just enough, especially for those guys. We've seen Sim 2 be a little higher spin, which was kind of a complaint from some players with original Sim. And now we've got a higher MOI platform. So you've got a more forgiving player's driver. And it's being called one of the better TaylorMade products in a long time. So Sim 2, you might see rival that kind of cult classic 2016 M2.
Wow.
Those are huge. Those are huge words, but I actually,
that's a bold take.
I agree, though. I've been playing TaylorMade drivers for, you know, I started using TaylorMade drivers like 12 years ago. I have a Callaway now. But this Sim 2 is like the best feeling overall performing, and it sits really nice in a while. Maybe you're right.
The reason that I'm saying that is, so I follow obviously a bunch of different golf sites and this, that, and the other thing. One of the sites that I'm a part of is a TaylorMade staff program. Site where a lot of guys that are on TaylorMade staff, you know, basically get in and talk shop and talk gear. And these guys are sounding off about this Sim 2. And there is a huge rumbling in the weeds here with the staff guys at the Greengrass properties and the people that are, you know, the working horses of the golf industry, talking about how good this driver is and how much an improvement they're seeing even over last year's Sim product. No, we're seeing it in the studios. We're seeing it in the company. And now I'm also getting feedback from, you know, a lot of the guys that are on the front lines with this product and using it before it's even available for retail sale.
Yeah, we say that, but DJ just won after taking it out. But Brooks did just put it in. And I think it's, you know, throughout the year, it's going to be really popular.
Balance the scale a little bit. One guy takes it out, one guy puts it in. Both high profile names.
Yeah. Ebbs and flows.
Yeah, ebbs and flows. Exactly right. By the Masters, DJ will have the Sim 2 back in the bag, though, for sure. Speaking of the Masters, these are not the two guys you want winning before the Masters if you're in the Masters field. Like, don't let Brooks and DJ get hot. That's a scary sight.
Yeah, I would agree. Those are probably the two guys on the list. If you're saying who do you not want to be in form going into Augusta?
Yeah,
the defending champ for sure, Koepka, who's been oh so close in recent years. I watched this Instagram video yesterday of Brooks just absolutely like lighting into like fellow playing competitors on the golf course, making fun of them. We've seen him over the years. I mean, when he was in the last year the PGA, and he was making comments about, you know, well, I've got, you know, how many majors and DJ's only got one. He does it where it seems kind of playful, but it's like, geez, the guy's kind of savage.
He just wants to like not be a cookie cutter golfer so bad. He just wants to be like an athlete, you know,
baseball. Yeah, exactly.
Where he can just talk.
Definitely stuff. Definitely more athlete than golfer, it feels like, with Brooks. And he's kind of always, he's always wanted it that way. Yeah. All right, so we go from Koepka's changes into, I feel like these two right here are probably two of the more interesting changes of the year. Guys who sought out people outside of their, I mean, this isn't like going to a tour rep and, you know, saying, hey, can I get a club off the truck? Let's start with Ricky Fowler. Now this one flew a little bit under the radar last week because Fowler missed the cut. He is he's struggling mightily with the putter right now. Before he did a little bit of a trunk slam on Friday afternoon, he ended up ranking 125th in strokes gained putting. He lost almost 4 strokes in the field with the putter. That's pretty rough. So what do you do when you're struggling with the putter? You try and find a solution. So, this is interesting. I mean, where would you go if you're a Scotty Cameron guy? You got Scotty Cameron probably on speed dial. You got the Scotty Cameron rep on speed dial. I'm sure he has some backup putters. But instead, Fowler gets a backup putter from his caddy.
That's desperation. Or he really likes that putter. Like he's putted with it a million times when he's at Joe's house or something. And he's like, hey, let me get that putter.
I mean,
back.
that's like my only, so his caddy gives him his putter and he uses it during the second round. Is he actually had a slightly better performance on the greens from the second round compared to the first, but Fowler's, I mean, I don't think that he's going to show up with his putter again in his next start.
We won't see that again, especially because he didn't really putt that well or play that well. But it actually kind of reminds me of Tiger Woods with Marco Mira's ping putter, his ping answer. Like he would always putt with Mark's putter. I've asked Mark about this. And he was like, yeah, Tiger would always just want to use my putter. And every time he did, whether it was 20 feet, 12 feet, 25 feet, he's making the putt. And he always tried to buy it off Mark, and Mark would never give it up. So that's actually eventually how Tiger ended up getting the custom Scotty. So
for me, when I heard this, it reminded me of 3 years ago in Charlotte when Justin Thomas borrowed one of Ricky Fowler's backups and ended up making the cut.
Yep.
And so you're thinking, surely JT's going to return the favor, hook Fowler up with a putter, but caddy to the rescue. And again, I agree. I don't think we're ever going to see it again.
Do you remember that story? Does the name Cody Blick ring a bell?
Yes.
So he's going into the web.com Q school final round. He's a Titleist staffer. He gets his club stolen before the final round. Like he has a chance to qualify and get status. Club stolen. So he ends up borrowing like a driver from the superintendent. He goes into the pro shop and just gets like stuff off the rack. He gets a putter from someone he knows, shoots 63 in the final round to qualify. And then, so he actually tracks the clubs down like a week or a month later. I guess someone found it in a homeless person's tent. Like his bag.
That's right.
They were all damaged and somehow he got it back. Like he paid someone $300 over Venmo to get the clubs back. Just too funny. This story, I don't even know why it reminded me of that, but yeah, just a crazy story. That was like 2-3 years ago, maybe, but classic. Shout out Cody Blick. If he's listening.
That is an amazing story, but Fowler wasn't the only guy in the field who was borrowing somebody else's clubs. I'm a little more attached to this story because of the player in question, Scottie Scheffler. Yeah.
You're getting so lucky sneaking this story in 3 weeks in a row. It's wild.
Always. Man. So the Nike VR Pro Limited 3-wood that we sort of poured one out for a few weeks back, Tursky sends me the text when he's in Phoenix. I get fired up, found out that actually wasn't, I thought for sure it had to be the backup. He had a backup one that I had mentioned, but the lie angle was off and just concerns of potentially trying to adjust it and snapping the hosel. Ended up finding, I guess, receiving one from Scotty G, Scott Garrison, who works for SST and KBS. And he had one. He just happened to bring it along, had it in his garage and brought it to Scotty. So that's where that 3-wood came from. It's not the backup, but it's good to have friends, as we say, in high places.
Yeah,
so
the two Scotties teaming up to get that Nike fairway wood back in Scheffler's bag.
I love it. Whatever it takes. But that's it. It looks like it's back in the bag for now. We'll see if it stays. So those are kind of the hot gear topics for the week. Get into this week's gear spotlight. And I'm going to talk about the new Scotty Cameron Phantom X putters, but I want to do it because, Tursky, you had a chance to sit down and chat with one of my favorite guys, one of yours, I'm sure, as well. And one of them that, for me, was like that moment where I'm like, man, I can't believe I get paid to actually be in this industry and do this for a living, Scotty Cameron. Yep. When he would call me and like, I've got his number and he's like, hey, Jonathan, how's it going? And like, we just kind of like talk putters. It's still wild to me. But you had a chance to talk about Phantom X and a couple other stories as well. How was that?
Yeah. I had talked to him in person before a couple times, but I never talked to him on the phone. And he calls me a couple days ago. I'm just like, hello. It was a random number that popped up. He's like, hey, it's Scotty Cameron. I was like, oh, oh, now this is fun. And he was like, what do you prefer to be called, Andrew or Andy? I was like, Andrew. I was like, what do you prefer to be called? He's like, Scotty. I was like, yeah. He really is just like so cool and laid back, like just a normal dude talking, kind of a surfer guy. And then we start talking gear and he just turns it up. You know, he is super smart and super passionate. You know, he really is like half artist, half engineer. You know, he knows how to make something look super cool. And he also knows why it works and technically how to get players what they want. But yeah, we were mostly talking about the new Phantom X5, X5.5, Phantom X11, Phantom X11.5, which is kind of a line extension to the Phantom X putters. They had the 5 and 5.5 before, but he updated them. The 5.5 is now like basically an exact replica of JT's putter, which is what
everybody wanted.
Or mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't have the same like weld on the neck that he has that people go crazy for, but he was, you know, basically like, you know, we're not hand welding all those necks for the retail version. plus it looks way cleaner, which it does.
Make it cost a little bit more money.
Right. I mean, it does look way cleaner. Plus you want to have something special for the 2021 or however many they actually made of JT's actual, like inspired by signature putter.
Right.
But so while we're talking Phantom X putters, you know, we go down some certain roads and I want to start asking him some questions. And I'm like, okay, so obviously we know that Tiger's Terrillium putter, super famous. We know the story behind it. We know the current putter that he plays, but I was like, I need to get the story behind the Laguna putter that he played at the Buick Open in 97.
You should preface that. How did you find out about this putter? Because you did a story on every putter that Tiger Woods had ever used. I mean, literally, like combing through Getty and stuff.
Literally, I went through every single putter that exists of Tiger's putter.
literally.
Find. And some random photo I found, he was standing with Nick Saban in like some chair, maybe it was a Wednesday pro-am or something like that, and he's holding the Laguna. I'm like, wait a second. So I start diving in deeper and I asked Titleist and they confirmed that he played a Laguna one time, 1 week. It might have been 2 weeks in a row, but it was 1 week he played a Laguna. It's like, whoa, that's
there's
nuts.
Gotta be a reason if Tiger's putting a putter in the bag. That's not an answer style head. You know that there's got to be a reason for it, especially when after you turn pro.
Yeah, so I got Scotty to fill me in on what happened, the backstory. So apparently back in the day, Tiger and Brad Faxon both used to go into Scotty's gallery to go and get like feedback. They wanted video and data on their strokes. You know, they're going in and working on their strokes while also like figuring out things to change. And Brad Faxon, the Fax Day putter, you know the Fax Day putter. It's basically a Laguna with a plumber's neck. And Scotty Cameron was saying, you know, Tiger always just idolized Faxon's stroke. So when he would go in, that says a whole lot. So when he would go into the gallery, he would ask Scotty Cameron to pull up Brad Faxon's data and video, his session. He wanted to see what he was working on. And eventually he asked Scotty to build him a Laguna because he was inspired by Brad Faxon's stroke and the way his toe flow of his putter, Scotty Cameron calls it a toe flow, you know, the way the toe releases through the ball. But what's funny is that when Faxon would come in, he would do the same exact thing with Tiger. He was inspired by Tiger's stroke. So he would ask Scotty to pull up his data and his video sessions to see what Tiger was working on. So without knowing, like, I don't think, like, were Tiger and Faxon huge friends? I never really associated them with each other. I think it was more of like a from afar, they wanted to get, you know, information on what the other was doing because they both just appreciated the greatness of the other.
It's the highest compliment. You the first thing that you're doing when you're going in there is you're looking to see what the other guy, the guy that you think is a better putter than you.
Yep.
What is he doing that I'm not doing that I should be doing? And if you can't do that, you might as well just try and see if you can use the same putter. I love that story.
Yeah. And it's one of my favorites that I've heard from Scotty Cameron, like, ever.
That's a great story. And I, again, so it just goes to show you two great putters. Just two great putters, man. I mean, the fact that they're not content to just do what they're doing, like they're seeking out every possible avenue to try and get better. And it just so happens that it's by looking at the data from another guy that they're going up against head to head in tournaments.
And so I asked Scotty, I was like, you know, what can an amateur golfer learn from a Faxon or a Tiger? Like, you know, what are they mainly working on? And he said length of putter, actually. He said they were focused on length of putter and really making sure that their eyes get directly over the center of the golf ball to make sure they can get that alignment and that the stroke is producing the direction, the starting direction that they want. I thought that was pretty interesting. I wasn't expecting him to say length of putter, but it goes to show you how important that aspect actually is to make sure, you know, you get that sole sitting flat. You don't want the toe up in the air. You don't want the heel up in the air. Well, I guess don't tell Stricker that, but you know, for most golfers, you want that sole sitting flat, and length is an important part of that, as well as lie angle, obviously. But you know, fitting's huge when it comes to putters, and people don't necessarily understand why. I'm not sure if you want to explain why, Chris, but.
Well, I was going to ask, what do you typically see golfers, average golfers come in with a putter that's too short or too long?
Mm-hmm.
More often than not, too long. And their eye line is way inside of that intended target line. So where the putter actually lays on the ground versus where their eye line sits, they're making a lot of manipulations with that face through impact, trying to get that eye line and target line squared up. Too long is way outweighing too short.
Interesting.
Yeah. I would have thought it would have been the opposite.
Right.
But. Interesting. Well,
you look at the quote unquote standard length for your average putter at 35 inches. How deep is the average golf bag? 35 inches. You go shorter than that, and some of the putters fall in the bag. And so putter manufacturer came up with a solution and said, hey, standard length, 35 inches. Now we don't have a problem.
Is that tinfoil hat conspiracy theory explanation, or is that really how we got a standard of 35? I always thought it was just, oh, the standard's 35 because Tiger uses 35.
I've been told that the bag depth played a part into the 35 inch quote unquote standard. Could be wrong.
That's nuts. And so like 80% of people use 35 inch putters, whereas they definitely shouldn't be, and they're playing it because of bag height. That's nuts.
You look at what is standard. I mean, standard length, standard swing weight, standard lofts. I mean, they're all over the place for everybody. Why would putter length be any different? Somebody said it was standard.
I'm starting to question.
I'm almost 6'5", and I play a 34-inch putter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just 5'10 on a good day, and I'm 33 and a half.
I mean, I use 35, so.
Yeah, I just all felt more comfortable. Having longer arms, like 34 has always felt more natural to me than 35. I don't know what it is. It's an inch. That's the craziest thing about this game. Is these little adjustments, even if it's like half an inch here or there, 35 to me feels like I'm using like a 40 inch putter for some reason. It's one inch. It's all mental. I'm a head case anyway. So I guess I'm not really that surprised.
At some point, someone told me to play a 35 inch putter. And I was
Tiger like, did. Yeah. Tiger told you to play 35 and you just followed him.
Listen, whatever Tiger says when it comes to comes to golf, I'm doing it.
That's it. How wrong could he be?
Speaking of, one more question. Who do you think Scotty says has the best Scotty Cameron putter collection of like guys on tour? I did ask him this and he did answer it.
That's good.
I'll say Faxon. Okay. I think Faxon's I've seen it. It's a pretty strong collection.
Okay. Chris, what's your guess? That's not right, J-Wall. Sorry.
Okay, my other answer would have been Charles Howell because he has
solid,
everything.
Two solid guesses, very solid. Both wrong, but great guesses.
I don't know. Let's go. What about Adam Scott?
Adam Scott, I bet, has some unique stuff. Wrong answer, but you know.
What about DL3? DL3?
No. Well, the first name he did bring up was Tiger. He's like, obviously his collection's awesome. He has some crazy stuff. But then he dropped, we've talked about this a bunch, J-Wall. He said Hideki has one of the best.
Why didn't I think about that? Hideki.
I know. He was like, yeah.
Never would have come up with that.
He was like, he stops by my gallery in Tokyo or Hamamatsu and just goes nuts. He is like, he was like, not only does he have a vast collection, he's like,
you mean a vault. Not only does he have a vault collection, exactly. In a, probably in a literal like vault.
Yeah, but he was like, he has some of the coolest stuff that I've made as well, which I thought was pretty sweet.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Hideki, why didn't I think about that? My other guess was going to be DJ.
Okay. Yeah.
But
well, when you see Hideki show up to every single tour event with 12 Scotties, and then his handlers also have 5, you know, You start to see why Hideki's why Scotty's collection is serious. Yep.
He usually does have some like one of a kinds. I remember a few years back in Phoenix, I shot his bag, and he of course had 5 putters with him, and each one of the putters I'd never seen it before, and they were all like unique necks. Head shapes that were probably, you know, at least a decade old. And I mean, yeah, just some like absolute classics in there. I feel ashamed that I didn't even like Hideki wasn't even in my top 5. And we talked about it all the time.
Well, when you go through all the people who have used Scotty Cameron putters, like throughout the years, you know, Hideki's not the one that immediately comes to mind, but then you think about it, it's like, yeah. He probably has 7,000 Scotty Cameron putters, all with like the high end, you know, German stainless
materials. Of course he does. Materials. Of course he does.
Yeah. Good for Hideki.
Good for Hideki. Not like he doesn't have everything already, but he also has the largest Scotty Cameron collection known to man.
Yep.
All right.
Somebody's got to be number one.
True.
Mailbag time. And we got 2 questions this week for Chris. First one. If I moved my clubs from standard to 1.5 degrees flat, would that have any impact on how high I'm hitting the golf ball?
Long answer or short answer?
I mean, there's no time limit on this podcast.
Let it rock.
Give me whatever answer you want.
Short answer, yes. Yeah, there's the short one. So if we want to get into that a little bit, you can definitely go down the rabbit hole on lie angle. I mean, you start to talk about it, average scratch player has roughly 4 degrees of ulnar deviation in their wrists as they come through impact. So lie angle becomes subjective, turf conditions that you play on, but if you're talking about just static lie angle adjustments and that toe starts to get into the turf a little bit before the rest of the blade, going to want to hold that face open a little bit. Going to want to present more loft at impact as the player releases the club through the turf and through the impact position. So you can see a little bit higher initial launch, a little bit more spin coming out of going a little bit flat. So the easiest answer is yes, it's possible to see a higher trajectory and more spin just by flattening out the golf club.
Interesting.
Do you recommend people make lie angle changes when they're trying to affect trajectory? Or should it be like, listen, just get the right lie angle for your swing so it's flat to the ground at impact? Like, what do you think about that?
So, I mean, that kind of goes back to the rabbit hole thing.
Right.
It's really subjective to the player. So, I mean, if I have a competitive player that comes to see me and I am consistently seeing turf interaction being toe down and I'm looking at that player and his start lines are exactly where he wants them to be, I'm going to be really hesitant to make a lie angle change because it's going to change his start line, which is then going to have an impact on the amount of curvature that player sees downrange. So even though it quote unquote fits and gives us better turf interaction, it doesn't necessarily do any favors for the player with the starting line that he sees in his mind and then the shot shape that he likes to play.
Interesting.
That was a good rabbit hole. I'm glad we dug into that one.
We go down plenty on this podcast. All right.
Absolutely.
Question number two for you. What order would you prioritize getting fit? Would you put the shaft first, head, length, lie, or grip? I feel like this is such a difficult one because they're all very important.
So let's good luck with this question, Chris. Have fun.
We can tackle this one. So
no rabbit holes.
Good question, by the way. So you look at that, and I look at every fitting essentially as a puzzle that I'm dumping out on the table. And as we spend time with the player, we start putting pieces together just to see the big picture. A lot of the answer to that question lies primarily in what's the goal of the player? What's the objective here? Are we looking for a different reaction out of the club head? Are we looking for more ball speed, looking for something different with spin, a different shape? Same thing with shaft. If we're looking at a different weight, a different bend profile, whatever the case may be. So you can attack any of those parameters with more priority than another, just based upon essentially what the goals and objectives are of the player. And if you're talking just basic fitting, where do we start and why do we do it, what have you, club head is going to be the biggest component to influencing performance. And then you get into shaft and you get into length of shaft, weight of shaft, and lie angle is going to be influenced by basically the weight of the shaft, the release of the player, and the bend profile of the shaft. So you can get more droop, more deflection, or less, depending upon how that player releases a certain weight or a certain bend profile.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really start getting into some of the fine-tuning components of fitting just with tinkering with bend profile and shaft weight. You'll see that also starts to play a part in effective lie angle as it comes through impact.
I do think as long as you have the right shaft, I think the club head's most important. Like if you're playing an A flex and you really need an X flex, you can really mess yourself up. You're never gonna go too far wrong if like your club head lie angle is 1 degree off or you know this or that. You know what I mean? So in terms of that, I would say shaft is more important than the head. But once you get into that right range for you, club head's huge.
Oh, absolutely. And we start the majority of our fittings with a baseline shaft. So if a player comes mm-hmm. to see you and he's in front of the fitter, we're going through, I'm watching him warm up and he's hitting his current irons pretty well. And I'm making note that, okay, this shaft is responding. It's keeping up with him. You know, we're in the right weight category. We're close on bend profile. We'll use that shaft or something very similar as a control shaft. And then we go right into head testing. Once we figure out the right head, we might tinker with shaft and get into that fine tuning component with maybe some different weights or different bend points or so on and so forth. But if you're watching a player, like you said, and I got somebody that's moving at 100 miles an hour with a 6 iron and he's coming rolling through here with some R300s, I'm going, maybe we need to tackle that shaft before we get into head testing.
Right. Let's address that one first.
Exactly.
That is a problem, sir.
That is an issue. And same thing with length. And if I'm blueprinting a player set and I say, okay, we got a 37.5-inch 6 iron, I keep referencing 6 iron because that's what we test with. So if we're at 37.5 inches for this player's 6 iron and he's diming it in the center of the face, I'm going, all right, this length is probably pretty close to where we're going to end up with. And I mean, if we revisit the Michael Phelps topic earlier, I mean, you've got somebody like Michael Phelps, he's tall, but really wide wingspan. He's playing 1/2 inch over standard clubs and has a 38-inch 6 iron. So I'll always kind of communicate to people when they ask about length, it's not necessarily how tall you are, it's how you are tall. So you can have big, tall guy with little bitty T-Rex arms, or you can have somebody like Phelps that has a 7-foot wingspan, and you go, yeah, standard to 1/2 inch over, probably going to work for him.
Or you could be 6'5", play a 34-inch putter like Jay Wall because you have super long arms too.
Depending on the irons I've played over the years, I've either been standard or a 1/4 inch over.
Okay.
1/2 inch to me always is, again, it's like it feels like it's a telephone pole in my hands. We're talking like 1/4 inch. But again, I'm weird. Well, I think more than anything, it just kind of stresses the importance of getting fit. And you know, there's a place you can go do that. Go to True Spec. Go see Chris.
Come and, see us.
And he'll get you hooked up. But no interview for this week. Hope you all enjoyed us riffing on all kinds of topics. But Tursky is going to be at Riv. I'm super jealous that he drew the short straw, and so he gets to go to Riv this year. So he'll be reporting live.
I'll send you a postcard.
Reporting live from there. And good interview that we have on tap for next week. Get into a new product that's coming out and some work that went into it with a pretty high profile name. Let me just tease it like that. So that'll do it for episode 78 of Fully Equipped. Thanks again for listening. If you want more gear news, you can also check us out on social media. We're at Fully Equipped Golf on Instagram and at Fully_Equipped on Twitter. Thanks again for listening. See you around.